Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's 5 minutes after the hour. It is Wednesday, November the 15th. Bill Arnold here, bringing you another day of a better product at a better price with faster delivery time, whatever that means. Obviously, I didn't sleep very good last night because I was up watching late-night infomercials, and that seems to be what they always say. Let me start with a passage out of Psalm 18. I love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. My God, my rock, in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. Here's another one, Psalm 9. I will give thanks to you, Lord, with all my heart. I will tell of all your wonderful deeds. I will be glad and rejoice in you. I will sing the praises of your name, O Most High. And this is my new memory verse coming up, Deuteronomy 31:8. The Lord himself goes before you and will be with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. So that's how I wanted to start. God's Word, there it is. Get things started. Today is also National Clean Out Your Refrigerator Day. So I'm going to maybe try to do that because there's something in the back of my refrigerator that I think has a pulse and is living rent-free. So I'm going to get a hockey stick and get it out of there. That's probably what it's going to take. So if you need to clean out your fridge, today's National Clean Out Your Fridge Day. Might be a good thing to do. Clean it out. Wipe it down. It's kind of a liberating little chore to get that cleaned out. So that's a little encouragement today. And I saw that late mafia boss's New Jersey home is for sale. It's for sale for $7 million, 6,500 square foot, 7-bedroom, 7.5 baths. Nice. And he did that all working part-time at Half Price Books. It's like, how do you afford that? Amazing. Anyway, we'll take a break, and then Karen Swallow Pryor is going to be with us. We'll be back in just a minute. Good morning. We're back. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Dr. Karen Swallow Pryor is a professor of English at Liberty University. She's a columnist and an author and a frequent guest of the show. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning.
Thank you for getting up and doing the show so early. Love having you on.
Oh, well, I'm glad to be here and talk about this important topic.
It is. Top of many news reports are what's going on with Judge Roy Moore. And I want to talk about how that mess and how we uphold God's standards and how it seems like evangelicals are a little conflicted over all these accusations. Can you help us process through this?
Well, I can try to help. As you said, it's very, very difficult. And I think it is important for us to process this and talk about it because so many of our core values are at conflict in this controversy, aren't they?
And they are.
It's just... my social media has been blowing up about this, and I've been passionate about a number of things, and really not even Judge Roy Moore himself in the case, but really more how we're responding to this kind of controversy and confusion. So I'm so glad that we're talking about it this morning. Of course, we have to state right off the bat that that a person who is accused is not necessarily guilty. Under the court of law, he is innocent until proven guilty. But he may never go to trial because of the statutes of limitations. So what we have to deal with is first of all, the voters of Alabama and even now in Washington, D.C., our politicians there have weighed in. We have to deal with how the decisions that we make about it, regardless of whether it goes to trial or goes into a courtroom. And more importantly than that, as I said, just how we process is a great example for us to talk about what we do with brothers and sisters in Christ when they are accused of wrong and or we suspect them of wrong, and not just any wrong, but a great wrong. So there's so many things packed into this situation. So I don't know where to start. Where would you like to start?
Well, why don't we start at, because you say the statute of limitations, let's start with the court of public opinion. Well, your social media is blowing up. In the court of public opinion, where does he stand?
Well, I mean, I'm seeing, there are a few couple different categories of the way that people are responding. First of all, my response is mainly has been because, I've written about this and I've been on the show talking about it before, is that when people, women or men, come forward and say that they have been abused, we must tend to believe them.
Mm-hmm.
That does not necessarily mean, it may not even mean that the person who did it. We don't know anything, but we have to assume that they are telling the truth and move forward to investigate that on that basis. And so, and one of the points that I have made that I haven't seen made is that even though an accused person is innocent until proven guilty under the court of law, we have processes in place where when someone is being investigated or is a suspect, there are limitations put on them. Even police officers who are accused of wrongdoing during an investigation or committing some crime, they are put on administrative leave while the investigation goes on because it's very foolish to allow anyone who's a suspect, even a legal court, an officer, to be free to do more possible harm, even if we aren't sure if they're guilty or not. So in other words, someone's innocent until proven guilty, but that doesn't mean we just let the person go on his merry way until we know for sure. That mm-hmm. would be foolish, and that would be wrong. So that's my perspective, and I'll put that out there. But then, of course, there are people, I'm hearing so many in my community, who are so concerned about the political ramifications of losing that seat in the Senate that they think it doesn't matter what he has done. They may not condone it. They hope it's not true. But we've got to get that particular person in the seat so that we have the kind of vote that we want. I'm seeing a lot of that, and I understand that view. I understand that's how a lot of people view politics. It's completely pragmatic, I think that we have to unpack that and talk about whether that's biblical and right, and I don't think that's the wisest, most biblical thinking. And then, of course, we're seeing people who are very, very quick to condemn and assume guilt and are just saying some over-the-top things as though we're absolutely sure that all these things are true. So that's a sort of three big categories, and a lot of people just going at one another and talking past one another about it.
Mm-hmm. So, Karen, do you think evangelicals are becoming increasingly more guilty of a double standard? Because if we're at the risk of losing a Republican seat, are they going to just simply look the other way and be more forgiving? And, of course, that doesn't make any sense from a God standpoint. Because we need to hold people accountable to their behavior, and we certainly don't want that kind of person and that person's kind of character in public office.
We are absolutely, as evangelicals, guilty of a horrific double standard that is increasing. There was a poll done in the past year, I believe, and there's a graph that's floating around on the internet that shows that 20 or 30 years ago, even when polled, same groups of people, different religious affiliations, when they were asked if a person of immoral character can, we believe that a person of bad character can do a good political job. 20 or 30 years ago, when the first poll was done, evangelicals, 38% or so, said no. And all of that was less than all of the other groups. Now evangelicals are up in the 70%, and I don't remember the exact numbers, that they say a person of bad character can do a good job above everyone else. Wow. So clearly we have shifted. And I think, you know, I'm old enough to remember the Bill Clinton scandal very, very well. And it's very surreal, because it's like the parts have stayed exactly the same, but the roles have been reversed. When my people, Christian conservatives, evangelicals, saw women coming forward accusing Bill Clinton of not only sexual misconduct, but actual, in one case, rape, we believed the victims and we thought Bill Clinton was guilty. And now this situation is almost exactly the same, except, of course, it involves some minor children. And I'm seeing the same people say what the liberals and Democrats said in defense of Bill Clinton today. Hmm. That's hypocrisy.
Indeed it is. Karen, let me take a little break. And when we come back, I know this is a challenging subject, but I certainly appreciate your take on it. And we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Karen Swallow Pryor, a professor of English from Liberty University, a columnist and author, in just a minute. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Good morning. It's 19 minutes after the hour. I have Dr. Karen Swallow Pryor on our studio line. She's a professor of English at Liberty University. She's also a columnist and an author and a regular guest here on the show. We're always, always glad to have her on. And Karen, as I've been thinking about this over the break, I know that it seems that politics starts off by attracting the wrong kind of people. There's people with good intentions, but there's so much power in politics, and the default position when it comes to power is personal sin and corruption, on steroids.
Yeah, we certainly have a political system that that seems to bring out the worst in most people, and it certainly doesn't attract the best people, I think. And even the good people who go there, I think it must be extremely hard for them to remain untainted by all of the corruption and the upside down values there. So it is very difficult. But on the other hand, I think what makes it worse is the way that we, as Christians, I mean, I don't blame unbelievers, but when we as Christians put so much faith in politics, the political process, and politicians. And I'm one who's always been, I mean, I actually ran for public office many years ago. So I'm one who is very politically active, and I believe very much in the importance of the law and the political process for human flourishing and for promoting Christian values and beliefs. So I believe all that. But it is not, you know, politics is not our king. And it's just a human institution that we happen to be under because in God's providence, he placed us here in this time in this country. But it is absolutely not of our final home, our true home and mm-hmm. the kingdom. It's just a tool. And I'm just seeing people sell out their souls and their faith and for a political seat. I mean, we cannot do things our way. We have to do things God's way, and let the results and let the consequences rest with Him.
Mm-hmm. Karen, I'm already
that includes how we vote, I believe.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I see. I'm already stuck on you running for office and what your catchy slogans might have been. Pryor has your priorities. What were they?
Well, I ran for Lieutenant Governor of New York on the Right to Life Party ticket, and
okay.
so everything was about the Right to Life.
Okay. Okay.
It was just a third party option.
Yeah. But when I look at, I was listening to the president yesterday talk about tax reform, and there were, you know, incentives like families could get $1,000 in their pocket for more spending, and I'm thinking, how does any of that matter with all the moral corruption in our country? Well, I mean, we talk about what's really not that important at the end of the day.
Exactly, and this is even going, you know, going back to the Judge Roy Moore situation. I'm seeing people who feel very, very conflicted because they feel like they will be morally responsible and responsible before God if they don't support him, and then an abortion rights politician gets that seat. And that is just having too little faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't think we are not supposed to do something wrong or support wrong. And I do believe it's wrong to support someone who has been accused when the evidence is so weighty. Again, he's not proven guilty, but there is credible evidence that something may be wrong. I think that's enough to say that we cannot be part of supporting that. Even though it happened so many years ago, clearly, I'm just not impressed with his response. Even if he's not guilty, if he understands the weight of the charges, and I mean, it seems there would be more humility and lamentation in addressing them, and I'm not seeing that from Judge Moore. Sadly, I wish I would see a different kind of character. Even if he were, you know, if he were innocent of the charges,
mm-hmm.
I wish I would see something different in his character. So I don't think that it's. I just think Christians need to be very careful to think that we have to be God and that we have to fix what we can't fix, and in doing that, you know, do something wrong, which is to support evil in order to do good.
Karen, what do you think evangelicals are, what is their default nowadays? Are they defaulting biblically or defaulting politically, do you think?
Well, I think more and more are defaulting politically, and the way that I hear it, I do think it's well intended. I do think that it's an attempt to do good, but I think there's sort of a division that people are making that I was taught by evangelicals not to make. This is why I still love evangelicalism and am an evangelical, because evangelical Christianity taught me. Beyond just being a believer, it taught me to integrate every area of life together in a biblical worldview, and that has been that has just shaped and formed who I am as a Christian. But now I'm seeing many evangelicals divide the political life out as though that's somehow separate, and that politics is politics, and you know we've got to do what it takes to get the best person in. And that's the right thing to do. But if it's not connected to first of all, our faith in God and our understanding that that man casts the lot, but the outcome is determined by God, which is the Bible tells us is the case, and to not see how our political decisions that we might, you know, we might vote for a person for one reason, but to not understand how all the other things that person brings into the office affects all issues as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if we elect a sexual predator in order to enact pro-life legislation, what we're also doing is increasing the need for abortion, because that's what sexual predation does.
Yeah, well, that was good analysis. It's obviously true. And I just, when I think about indefensible acts, we as Christians, I think, obviously need to stand strong against those and not look the other way to try to get some political agenda going. Because what you say, Karen, is so right. Let's trust God for the big results.
Right. And not do wrong, even you know, a small wrong in trying to do a great right. I think that's what how people are seeing it. And I understand it. These are very difficult political times, and we do not have very good political candidates in front of us in most of our elections.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, if we keep, you know, if we, just to speak politically, if we keep on voting for these undesirable candidates, we'll keep getting them.
Yeah.
And so we'll just exacerbate the problem. It'll just continue because we're settling so often for less than what we should be.
Karen, thank you so much for coming on and sharing these thoughts and having this analysis, which is certainly helpful for us because these are very difficult issues as we have conversations with people at work and in our neighborhood, and we have to stand up for the gospel always.
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 Thank you.
Thank you. It is 27 minutes after the hour. We'll take a break, and then we'll hear a little bit of laughter from Ken Davis. We could use that right now. It's 31 minutes after the hour. Special thanks to Dr. Karen Swallow Pryor. And just to recap a statistic she gave us, in 2011, 30% of white evangelicals said that an elected official who commits an immoral act in their personal life can still behave ethically and fulfill their duties. Today, 72% do. Wow. We'll take a break for news and be back in just a few minutes. Twenty-five minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. Kent Kaiser is already in studio making lively conversation. Hopefully that will continue when we bring him on the air. But the Bible is clear about how we can relate to God, others, and ourselves on a deeper level. We can do our part by applying its truths to our lives on a daily basis. Here's Ken Sandy of Peacemakers Ministries.
We group them as God awareness, God engagement, the top of our circle. Then down the right-hand side, it's self-awareness, self-engagement. And then the lower left-hand side of the circle is other awareness, other engagement. And you can put every verse in the Bible into that circle in one of those three areas, because every verse in the Bible is telling us how to know and love God, how to understand and manage ourselves, and how to read and minister and love our neighbor.
If you want to hear that full interview, Ken Sandy, spell that name S-A-N-D-E, Ken Sandy, and you can go to myfaithradio.com and type his name in, and you'll get right to that interview, hopefully. We'll take a short break and then come back, and Dr. Kent Kaiser is across the studio table from me. We'll bring him on in just a minute.
In our culture, youthfulness is celebrated while aging is dreaded. We're obsessed with the next generation. This is Jim Garlow. Wisdom is so rarely valued and pursued. Yet Leviticus 19:32 states it succinctly, "Stand up in the presence of the elderly and show respect for the aged." And the New Testament echoes the Old Testament, "You who are younger, be subject to the elders." Our children need to learn to interview grandparents, to hear the wisdom they have to share. Today, it's as simple as a smartphone video at the dinner table or using FaceTime and Skype. Those who've gone before us leave us with a testament of God's sustaining grace, or his story of his provision and his love, a heritage of faithfulness passed on through godly lives. Let us learn from the generations before us, and let us pray that we become them. This is Jim Garlow.
Good morning. That'll get you up on it. Just don't put a kilt on. That's the walk-up music for Dr. Kent Kaiser. He's in studio with us. Good morning, Kent.
Good morning.
So nice of you to be here. Let's get our discussion started with some of the top things in the news today. The Senate Republicans still plan to repeal Obamacare's individual mandate as part of the tax plan.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now they've slipped that into the tax plan. We'll see what happens, because there are some senators who have some huge reservations about it, just like they did when they voted on it as a clean bill. Susan Collins from Maine, for example, has some reservations about it. But it might be just sort of one of those little bargaining chips or something between the Senate and the House. I don't know. You know, maybe they're just making a point with it. But I think most Washington Republicans agree that it'll be very important to get tax relief or tax reform through. And so when all said and done, I wouldn't be surprised if this were jettisoned out of that bill and we just got tax reform.
Yeah. Well, they probably need to get something going, don't they, before now and the end of the year?
Well, yeah. And by the way, I mean, if they did happen to get this, the repeal of Obamacare's mandate through, that would definitely be a big savings. Like, mm-hmm. I can't remember what I saw, $1.6 billion or something. A huge savings. So certainly to offset the tax cuts that are coming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about Jeff Sessions. I guess he knew of some of the Russia ties, despite some testimony. Is he waffling a little bit?
I don't know. I'm not a fan of this guy. I can tell you, I never have.
It's been challenging, hasn't it?
It really has, to know exactly where he stands and just some of the things he's done. I don't think he's served the president very well. I don't think he's served our country very well with this waffling back and forth on whether he had a conversation about Russia or whatever. I just, you know, I think his days are numbered. I thought that a while ago, though, too, and he's still around. So, I don't know why he's still around.
Yeah. What did you think about Loretta Lynch?
Well, I thought, you know.
You can't make a blowing noise. You've got to say something.
So biased. I don't even know. Like, you know, I don't even know where do you start, you know. But, no, I just think that, you know, it's not as though he's as bad as Loretta Lynch, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, you know, in a way, you kind of wish that he would, you know, I don't know. I just think that, you know, I think we might now get another special counsel to look at the Clinton Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's a bad idea. I think,
okay.
Well, in the past, like, presidents have gotten elected and then we haven't gone after their past political opponents. And it's kind of a bad precedent to set. You know, and I know Trump has talked about it a lot, but that's the very reason not to do it.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's in a way, like, let that bygone be bygone. And don't, we shouldn't have the Office of Attorney General turn into some kind of arm of the political parties that happen to be in power at the time. You know,
good point.
And that's kind of what's going on with this, because it's a pretty, they're talking about this uranium deal that Clinton was on a board that voted in favor of allowing it to go through. And she wasn't the only one on there, and others voted for it. So, I mean, it's really kind of going after what at this point is a red herring, I think. And I just don't think that we should have our Justice Department being put in that position of being a political tool.
And then what do you make of where James Comey is in this whole process?
Well, I think he had bad judgment, too. See, this is the thing. I mean, we just got – I wish that we could just start with new people.
I mean, wasn't he always the nonpartisan, I'm just the FBI, and then all of a sudden – it went from, the Clinton scandal went from an investigation to a matter.
Yeah, see, and that's the thing. I don't understand, you know, again, I think he became politicized towards the end of his career. Maybe he always was. Mm-hmm. We only heard about him in the later part of his career. But right, I mean, he had a little conversation with Loretta Lynch, and suddenly this whole scandal kind of gets swept under the rug. And he waffled again. You know, everybody saw that during the election year. You know, first they were investigating Clinton's emails, and then they weren't, and then they were again. And, I mean, he dropped that bomb, 10 days or so before the election, and probably did have an impact on the election. And just because, you know, he seemed to be uncertain, and nothing ever came of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that leads you to believe that there was political motivation behind what he was doing, too, which is really unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. And then what is your thoughts on Judge Roy Moore?
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, no more grunting.
Yeah, I know.
No more grunting or blowing.
You know, see,
grunting.
Here's the thing. It's like, unfortunately, the election laws are different in every state. If this were in Minnesota, he could be forced to get out and somebody else could be put onto the ballot. And that actually happened here in a governor's race in 1990, where there was a very, I think what was, in comparison, a very minor scandals. Similarly, the candidate and young girls and so on, but minor compared to what you're hearing coming out of Alabama right now. But in Minnesota's system, we were able to replace the candidate just a couple of weeks before the election, and then that replacement candidate actually won in our state. In Alabama, the election laws appear to be different, so I don't know, even if he were to quit the race, I don't know whether he'd be able to be replaced. And in some states, I know you definitely can't be replaced. What this means going forward for election law, at least, is that perhaps Alabama, the legislature, will probably look at their laws and say, hey, we need to revise these in some way for this particular contingency. And that's kind of how election law goes. You never really know if you have really good laws on the books to cover all eventualities until they happen. Mm-hmm. And then all right. of a sudden they happen. I mean, that happened in Minnesota again. We had a plane crash 10 days before an election, and it had a U.S. senator on board who died. And then after the fact, then you learn all the little pieces of election law that need to be or should be altered for such an eventuality. And mm-hmm. so then in the next legislative session, things were fixed. That's kind of the situation I think Alabamans are in right now, where they're looking at their election laws like, this isn't working out so good for us. And so I suspect that in the next legislative session there, they're going to try and fix some stuff. But in the meanwhile, they're left with this horrible mess. And it's, I mean, I always think of things, of course, from a public relations perspective, and if this is your candidate as the Republican Party of Alabama, this is bad. And even if the guy gets elected, I don't even know what happens then. I mean, the Senate, Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate, other senators have said that this guy is unfit for office. Mm-hmm. If he does get elected, they may not seat him, and it is their prerogative. I don't know what the process is after that, though, and I think we might all learn. And in a way, I'd be kind of interested to see him get elected so that we could all learn this little civics lesson. But on the other hand, I don't know that I want to see him get elected, because it's just another PR nightmare for the Republican Party.
Yeah, so, and the Republicans are losing either way on this one, aren't they?
They really are. There's no, as far as I can tell, there's no good situation out of this, unless Alabama has a law where he could get out and they could replace him. But I don't know that they do. I mean, so far, nobody's really been talking about that. They've been talking about putting a write-in candidate in, and that might just dilute the vote in such a way that the Democrat will win, because the Republicans' votes would be split. We have seen a write-in candidate win in this kind of a circumstance a few years ago with Lisa Murkowski in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a different situation. She was famous. She was well-liked, and she was up against a kind of an out-there, you know, fringe candidate. And so she was able, with a small population, by the way, she was able to, you know, have a successful write-in candidacy. I don't know that that same thing could be replicated in Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Kent, let me take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you about some of the authorities in California that are telling churches, stop feeding the homeless. We'll talk about that. And another piece that I have a question about, Christianity's unique effect on the human dignity. Talking to Dr. Kent Kaiser, we'll be back. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. It is 11 minutes until the top of the hour. I have Dr. Kent Kaiser with me in studio. Always a delight. And I say that, and I mean it. So, Kent, let's talk about what's going on in Malibu, California.
Yeah, California. Didn't you used to live out there or something?
I did, yeah. But people in Malibu are a little nuts, because they are. So they're saying don't feed the homeless anymore.
I don't understand. I guess Malibu must be a really nice neighborhood.
It's very nice. And, yes.
And what they're saying to this one church is that they want them to stop feeding the homeless, because they seem to think that feeding the homeless creates more homeless. it's nuts. I don't know if it's just that they don't want the homeless flocking to their neighborhood for free food, or what's going on here. But basically, this church is being banned from feeding homeless people. And the city's had no comment. That's the other thing. They're not even giving their reasoning for this. You know, the mayor won't respond or anything like that. But it appears that they think that by helping the homeless, you create more homeless. Like if you create an incentive of free
homeless.
Food to be
yeah.
homeless, that more people will get on board with being homeless. It's nuts.
Yeah. Well, when you listen to the person who is homeless, this gentleman was interviewed, and he said, everyone is welcome. The food's really good. It's home-cooked, and there's tender, loving care involved. And he said, it keeps my spirits up. They keep me accountable. He says, when you're homeless, it's easy to slip off and become jaded. So there's a little sense of community there, just, right. you know, and that's actually helpful.
Well, yeah, no, it would be easy to have a sense of community centered on something bad, like drugs or stealing or something else. And here they have this community that's based on having a good home-cooked meal. Mm-hmm. And the city wants to squelch this. I don't understand.
And, of course, they're not really making much comment. The mayor's office really hasn't said much, and we're not hearing any response from the city of Malibu.
Right.
Other than stop feeding the homeless.
I think it's just that it's one of those situations, a rich neighborhood, where if they don't see the homeless, they think the problem doesn't exist or something. And I suppose they see this church and these people congregating there, like people do at a church,
mm-hmm.
and they don't like what they're seeing or something. I'm sure it's the optics of it for many of these people. It's not that they're actually interacting with the people, the homeless people. It's probably not that they're actually coming there to help and volunteer or have anything to do with it. They just don't like the optics.
So do you think that trend will continue, or do you think that's just a one and done?
I hope it's a one and done. You know, I hope we wouldn't see this in our community here in the Twin Cities or something. But, yeah, I hope it would be the opposite here.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about in a post-Christian world, let's talk about innate human worth. It seems like it's going away.
Well, it seems like there's this question that's been rattling around for quite some time, and that is, do you need God to be good? And oftentimes you'll hear atheists and non-believers try to claim that you can be good without God, without having God or without having belief. And many scholars have looked at the question and really come up with the conclusion that, yes, you need God to be good. In fact, Christianity has brought about something very different in the Western world than existed before Christianity, and that is things like compassion for people with disabilities, compassion for the elderly, compassion for children, compassion for people in distress. These are qualities that did not exist before Christianity. And in fact, there's one atheist theologian. It seems like an oxymoron to me, but whatever. He claims to be an atheist.
That's a title? Atheist theologian?
Atheist theologian. His name is Don Cuppet, who wrote, nobody in the West can be wholly non-Christian. We cannot help continuing to be influenced by the old dreams, as, for example, Marxists, anarchists, utopians, Martin Luther King, John Lennon, and Jürgen Habermas were, when they all continued to pursue some version of the old biblical version of a fully reconciled, free, and open future society, the messianic kingdom here on this earth. Whether or not you personally think of yourself as being a Christian does not very much affect the extent to which Christianity goes on influencing your hopes and your dreams. You may call yourself a non-Christian, but the dreams you dream are still Christian dreams, and you continue to be part of the history of Christianity. That's your fate. You may consider yourself secular, but the modern Western secular world is itself a Christian creation. That's an atheist writing that. And I think there's a lot to it. Others have noted this similarly. You know, it's interesting if you think of biblical stories. You know, one of the famous stories, of course, is the Good Samaritan. The reason that the Good Samaritan was remarkable enough to make it into the Bible was that he was an oddball of the time, somebody who came along and actually cared for somebody who was in distress. That would not have been the norm pre-Christianity. The norm would have been the other people who either walked around or kicked the guy and stole more from him or something like that. And so I think we oftentimes underestimate the influence of the whole Christian worldview on our society. I mean, it's easy to get caught up, and yes, there are still bad things that take place. We see violence and we see crime and so on, and disrespect and so on. But there's sort of this overlying idea that those are all bad things,
mm-hmm.
and that would not have necessarily been the case pre-Christianity. And there is still this sense of, you know, taking care of, like I say, the elderly and young people and so on. And in fact, If you also think back to Aesop's fables, I have the collected works, and there's the people who wrote it make note of this too. You remember Aesop's fables are often about animals,
mm-hmm.
and it's most appropriate because people treated one another sort of like animals. And so mm-hmm. it wasn't just like, we're going to turn these animals into, we're not going to anthropomorphize them. In other words, we're not going to give them human qualities. But in fact, humans had the qualities of animals back in Aesop's day, pre-Christianity. And they make this observation that the underlying ethos of the world of Aesop is that you're on your own. If you meet people who are unfortunate, kick them while they're down. And the law of the jungle seemed to prevail in the world of men as well as in the world of animals for Aesop. And that's why the animal stories were so appropriate. And again, they make this point that, you know, before Christianity, we didn't have this sort of ethic of taking care of other people and human compassion
mm-hmm.
and that we do have in existence today.
Mm.
Wow, that's really interesting, Kent. Thanks so much for being here. I always look forward to Wednesdays with Kent Kaiser. Have a great day.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. It is 4 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a little break and then come back and wrap up hour one. We got a great hour two coming up with Bill English starting off next hour. Be back in a minute. It is a couple of minutes until the top of the hour. Thank you to Dr. Kent Kaiser and Dr. Karen Swallow Pryor. What a great first hour we had. Next hour, we've got Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com, and then David Wheaton is going to be with us talking about cultural Marxism. What is it and why we should care? I'm so glad you're with me today. It is a couple minutes until the top of the hour. We'll be back in just a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.